Hey, all you rockers out there, this is Dave Menichetti from YNT, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer. Turn it up.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. This week on the show, Dave Menichetti of YNT discusses the loss of the YNT master tapes in the Universal Music Fire and what it means to the band's legacy. Now, as you may know, in 2008, there was a fire in the Universal lot in California, which destroyed over 100,000 audio tapes, including a huge part of music history. The fire destroyed the audio masters from bands like Nirvana, Soundgarden, Beck, Muddy Waters, Chuck Berry, Eminem, Lynyrd Skynyrd, 100-plus more artists, including YNT. Dave recently shared the news online, and we speak with him today about that audio tape loss, how he found out the news, dealing with Universal before and since the word of the fire came to light, and what happens next. Now, in case you don't know, YNT is coming out with a documentary later this year, as well as just releasing a vinyl record for YNT Acoustic Classics Volume 1, available at yntrocks.com. And if you end up getting the new YNT record, you're going to want to make sure it's properly cleaned with the Groove Washer record cleaner. If you're investing in vinyl and the audio experience, make sure it sounds its very best with a Groove Washer, available at your local record store or by going to groovewasher.com. It is the biggest bang for the buck in record cleaning. I use my Groove Washer every day, sometimes two or three times. It's a fantastic product. And I'll tell you what, here's 10% off anything at groovewasher.com when you use checkout code VINYLGUIDE10. That's everything, record cleaners, placemats, record accessories, all 10% off using promo code VINYLGUIDE10. Go to groovewasher.com now, 10% off with checkout code VINYLGUIDE10. Now, before we start the interview, I need to tell you about the Vinyl Guide Archives. If you like this interview and or the music of YNT, make sure you check out all the interviews of the Vinyl Guide available online, including Dave Menichetti himself, sharing the vinyl history of YNT, episode 121 of the Vinyl Guide. Also in today's episode, we discuss a conversation I had with Phil Lewis of LA Guns, talking about all sorts of stuff, episode number 123 of the Vinyl Guide. Rudy Sarzo of Ozzy Osbourne's band and Quiet Riot and all sorts of other groups, he discusses his history with vinyl records, as well as the last days of Randy Rhoads, episode number 66 of the Vinyl Guide. And of course, we welcome Joe Satriani, episode number 106 of the Vinyl Guide, all available on the Vinyl Guide app. Just search Apple or Google Play stores for The Vinyl Guide. Get the free app and enjoy our entire library of artists and vinyl-related interviews anytime. And with that, let's talk to Dave Menichetti of YNT.
Good after morning, whatever it is over there.
Yes. Good after night. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing all right.
Good. Hey, I got to tell you, Ben, so this show, The Vinyl Guide, it's starting to get quite popular, right? I mean, it's been a bit of a juggernaut the last couple of years, to the point where I'm starting to get interviewed now. And I was given an interview to someone recently, I think it was a newspaper somewhere, and they asked me, you know, with all the people you've had on the show, all the interviews you've done, do you ever get nervous? And I said, you know what, the one guy I got kind of nervous about was Dave Menichetti of YNT, because this
he's such an asshole,
he's
right?
Such an asshole. He's known as this tyrant, and no, he hurt my feelings. No, I said, you know, this is a guy that, you know, I've idolized for years. I grew up with his music. You know, he was a hometown hero, and he was my very first concert. And I said, that was the guy out of everyone I've interviewed, that was the guy that I got nervous about.
Well, that's cool. I like that. You know, I mean, that gives me a little distinction in my bland world.
Oh, it's hardly bland. No, so I'll obviously, you know, I'm not so nervous anymore. I'll keep the fanboy stuff down. But if you could send me a lock of your hair, that would be great.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I can do that, man. It's, you know, I got to keep what I got.
By the way, everyone who hasn't heard episode number 121 featuring Dave and the history of Y&T, go back and listen to it, because we track the history of this band album to album. We talk all about the rare vinyl and everything. Today on the show, unfortunately, we're going to cover a topic that is quite painful, the loss of the Y&T tapes in the Universal Music Fire of 2008. So, Dave, apologies if we're going to go deep into a heartbreaking place here this afternoon. Do you have a coffee or tea or anything, everything ready that you need to go there?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. I'm, you know, I've kind of resigned myself to whatever it was, you know, at this point. I can't live life worrying about it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of a bit of a backstory, if everyone's not aware, in June 2008, there was a fire at the Universal Studios lot in Hollywood, and apparently it was a tape storage facility, and they didn't tell anyone for years. In fact, they pretty much dismissed any reports of the fire as, you know, burning things that were inconsequential. But in a recent article in the New York Times, they listed over 120,000 tapes, or assets as they called them, that were destroyed. Maybe 500,000 songs, bands like Nirvana, Beck, Soundgarden, John Coltrane, Muddy Waters. It's a heartbreaking list of hundreds, maybe thousands of artists, including Y&T. So, Dave, can you share with me a bit of an overview about what Y&T lost in that blaze?
All right. So as we understood it, really, I mean, of course, I heard about this fire a couple of weeks ago, or about a month ago, whatever it was now. The time is kind of racing by, but nobody was really talking about anybody else other than like the top 10 or 20, you know, really large artists out there that have been around for, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. So we didn't know. We had an idea about it. And so Jill got a hold of the guy that runs that whole vault for Universal. And he got back to her about a week later after researching it and said, okay, here's what's going on. Here's what we still have in other vaults. And this is what is gone in the fire. Well, he listed something like 10 different items. Guess what? Six of them were the actual, you know, original master analog recordings of, the mixes, the actual analog masters, both in half inch and quarter inch analog tape of Earthshaker, Black Tiger, Mean Streak, Down for the Count, and Open Fire Live. So that's basically almost everything we recorded on A&M Records, with the exception of Down. Well, see, I don't know. Did they say Down for the Count now? I have to remember. We'll have to look back on that. But I think it was either everything that we recorded on A&M or everything minus Down for the Count. But nonetheless, I mean, those top four certainly are still considered to be
the heart of the catalog,
really. The heart of the catalog, absolutely. And you know, it was devastating. At first, I thought, okay, wait a minute. Now they do have backups of these things, but all the backups are on some weird format, like some 6130 or whatever they're called. I can't even remember what they are.
Quarter
kind
inch
of like,
U-matic or something like
yeah,
that.
U-matic. And I've seen them before, and it's kind of like, oh, geez. Okay, so wait a minute. So I'm looking at the list right now of the fire. Okay, half inch, Earthshaker, In Rock We Trust side one, In Rock We Trust side two, Down for the Count side one and two, In Rock We Trust again side one, Stereo Master, and the flat safety. So even the safety master is gone from In Rock We Trust. And master of Mean Streak, In Rock We Trust, Mean Streak, Open Fire, In Rock We Trust, and then all the quarter inch masters, everything. Just about everything that you'd ever want to use as a master if you were going to re-release or do another reissue or anything like that. So and again, we do have backups of these things, but they're on PCM 1610/1630 audio tapes. Oh, and even some of those are lost in the fire as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at all of this stuff. It's pretty amazing. The stuff that they have left is some of the stuff says unknown configuration, and 1 inch, and they're just all kinds of strange things that I don't even know what the hell they are. I mean, when I look through this stuff, as I had done before, when we did our own remasters of Earthshaker, Black Tiger, Mean Streak, and A Rock We Trust, these were what we were sourcing when we did those remasters. I mean, I went into the studio with the mastering engineer, and it was just the two of us for, you know, pretty much about a week to do all four of these. And I'm looking at those analog tapes, and there they are, you know, straight from the factory, from the vault that they sent up to us. And it was so cool to hear them back on analog again. And there's a certain thing about it. Yes, you can make copies of this stuff because it's already out there in the digital domain, but it's not the same thing. There's an emotional value that's connected to it and sort of a historic value that's connected to it. These are the things that I remember as they were mixing them down. I mean, these were the actual tapes. These were the original masters that they made the original records from and the CDs from. So that's kind of like a whole part of my history that just went up in flames. And that's kind of how it feels to me and how it felt for a couple of weeks. I think I was kind of depressed about the whole thing, you know, without being over the top. I mean, obviously there's not much you can do about it. It's gone. So, but it's, you still sort of mourn the whole experience and everything that it meant to you.
So those remastered versions that you did, I think, yeah, Earthshaker, Black Tiger, Mean Streak, I think In Rock was part of that as well. Those were those tapes that were lost in 2008. So you did those remasters before that, slightly before that, and then sent the masters
back.
Yeah,
I think we did the remasters around 2005, 2006, something like that. Hmm. And so, you know, we skirted right out of there. But you know, there, and the thing is that a lot of people don't understand, we got a lot of comments online, and they're like, well, hey, I just got these remasters from somebody in the UK, and that was just done a year ago. You know, what are you saying? They had to have had the masters. And I said, well, you don't know. You don't know because they don't tell you exactly where they sourced the original from. And it's probably, if it's the best it could be, I would say it would be a safety copy of one of the other copies of the master, but of the original analog masters. But likely, and what happens a lot nowadays, is that they'll take it straight from a CD, and they'll literally re-EQ it, recompress it, relimit it, and do everything off of a CD that's already been released. Mm-hmm. So, you know, or they'll get a digital copy somehow or another, and it's going to be a copy of a copy, basically. So it's not quite the same thing. And not to deride at any of those remasters. I mean, they could very well be sound fantastic. You know, who knows? There's a lot of things you can do with things, even though you're taking a second or third generation. It doesn't matter. There's a lot of technology that you can make things sound pretty good. But
in a way, it does matter, though. You want to get close to the source, and those tapes that you had, the ones that unfortunately you lost, but you did the remasters of, you know, in 2006. I mean, those were the original ones. Those were the closest to the source. Those are the ones that were band approved. I mean, those are the exact tapes that when the sound was coming through the speakers, you know, all four band members were kind of looking at each other and nodding. And
exactly. And of course, the next step after that is, all right, a lot of these were recorded to quarter inch and half inch at the same time. They were done. You know, we had those two machines sitting there, and then we sit and you know, wait a few seconds and then listen back right off of those tapes and make our determination. Which one do we want to use as the master? Do we want the quarter inch or the half inch? I mean, most times it was the half inch because the wider the tape, which means that it's a bigger head gap on there. So you're literally getting more information on the tape. And so I am an audiophile. So, and I always have been, well, I won't say always have been, I've been an audiophile since I was probably 13 years old. I've always been seriously into it. And spent a lot of years of the first part of my career spending whatever money I had on state-of-the-art speakers and amplifiers and all that kind of stuff. So I'm the guy that would be really, really anal when we'd go in and do these masters, because I did not want them to slam the levels on these remasters like everybody else was doing at that time, because I want some of the actual fidelity to be there, and there to be some, you know, low parts of the mix and high parts, you know, the kinds of things that happen. A dynamic range, and the dynamic range is lost to so many people that remaster things and they slam the levels so that even the quiet parts are just as loud as the loud parts, and that just gives you ear fatigue after three or four songs, and it ruins the whole thing. So we were very careful about getting these things to sound the best they could. And what goes along with what you were saying is that we were using the closest thing we possibly could to the original. We were using the original masters. So there you have it. And that really made a difference, especially when I was listening back in headphones. I was like, wow, this is so cool. I mean, there's an obvious bump in the analog tape after so many years, because that's just what happens with that. It's a petroleum product, and it needed to be baked before they sent it off to us, because if you don't, then the oxides will come right off the first time you play it, you can never play it again. So, you know, there's all these kinds of things that need to happen, but it's still a very special experience.
Oh, of course. And of course, you probably recognize the handwriting on the tapes, the ones from, you know, your own handwriting from 20-some years ago.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I remember that I was looking at the sheets that were in each one of these boxes. And not only the handwriting on the outside of the box, but the comments on the inside. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's Tom's, you know, writing, or that's so-and-so's writing. Yeah, it was cool. Mm-hmm.
Phil spilled a coffee on this one. And
exactly.
Now, when you did those remastered editions, did you create a safety master for vinyl, or anything you created from that was also in the blaze? Okay.
Yeah, there are some safeties from all of that on a DVD, but it's also on a flat file, a digital file that we have for that as well, that I can, again, you know, put back on a DVD or a CD and send that off for, you know, if I ever wanted to do another remaster. Now, the good thing is, and if there's a light at the end of all of this, is that the 2-inch 24 track tapes are still good. They're still there. And so if anybody ever wanted to go back and remix a record, that is still a possibility, because all the original 24 tracks are still there.
Oh, okay. All right. Because when I first read your blog post on this, I thought everything went, even the 2 inches.
No, just the 1/4-inch and 1/2-inch masters, which is what everybody uses to do a record off of, or a new CD or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Nobody would ever use the 2-inch 24 tracks unless they were going to do a really big project and remix an entire record from scratch, which would be fun on certain records, but you know, just to kind of like give a spin on what you can do now, you know, or what we could do after the fact, you know, what we maybe didn't like about the way that the producer mixed or the engineer mixed this particular record, we could give it a new spin if we wanted to. But boy, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously those are kept in a separate location. Was it a
separate location?
Okay.
Yes.
Separate city or what?
I don't know if it's some of them. I remember in the old days I'll just say back in about 2005, 2006, whenever it was that we got all of this and redid the masters on those, Universal sent us a PDF file that was something like 30 or 40 pages long of every single thing they had for Yesterday and Today Y&T in their catalog, in their vaults. And it showed where each item was and in what vault and in what city. And most of them were in Southern California, but there were a few that I remember they had something on the East Coast somewhere, but I don't remember what it was. And it may be, you know, again, some sort of backups or, you know, I don't know exactly what they were, but that was a long time ago. I'd have to look back on those to be absolutely certain.
Okay, so let's explore that a little bit, because I'm keen to understand kind of the journey of the tapes, because you've been making music since, was it 77? Was that the first Y&T album?
Yesterday, yeah, today? we We were actually, our first record was out in 76.
All right, so yeah. You had two albums as Yesterday and Today, the self-titled and then Struck Down.
Correct.
And those were on London Records.
Correct.
And so once young Y&T, or Yesterday and Today, I should say, recorded those albums, 2-inch tape, they mastered it down, they sent the master tapes. Where did those master tapes go?
Well, according to that PDF that I got some 15 years ago or so, it was in Universal's, one of Universal's vaults, because Universal took over a lot of different record companies. They took over all this. Everything that we've done, in fact, is at Universal, with the exception of Yesterday and Today Live. And that was done in 1990. And of course, all of our stuff that we've done since then. But they took over all of our Geffen stuff, all of our A&M stuff, and all of our London stuff. So that was the majority of what we had recorded up until 1990. So from 76 through 1990.
So that was just a coincidence that everything from your career up at that point just seemed to go to the same source, the same vault?
Yes.
Even?
Yeah. Well, some of them were in the same vault, yes. And in fact, when we said that we wanted to do a reissue of the Yesterday and Today records, you know, it was a really difficult thing for them to find it. And they're still having troubles finding it. And when Jill has now been talking to Universal about doing the licensing of all the songs we're using on the documentary, they're like, well, okay, well, wait, but we can't give you the okay on the Yesterday and Today stuff because we don't have it in our catalog anymore. And she goes, wait a minute, you guys had it in your vault. Oh yeah, but you know, so many years ago we sold all that stuff off to so-and-so. So then she contacts so-and-so and they go, oh yeah, well those guys went out of business and they sold it to so-and-so. And so it's like, nobody knows where these Yesterday and Today tapes are, and nobody knows who's licensing it. Well now, no, okay, Jill's now said that she figured it out eventually and it all went back to Warner. So Warner somehow has those tapes and has the rights for the licensing of those. But, you know, we don't know where they are, actually. We never asked, where are the actual masters?
Okay. At least now you know they're somewhere. They weren't in that Universal fire.
We think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So obviously, let me just put this down to what I glean from this whole thing. That particular vault that caught fire was probably where they kept all the original analog masters of everybody's records. And then they kept all the other stuff, in other vaults, like the 2-inch 24 tracks, the analog master copies and all these other flat files and digital copies and so on and so forth. So in other words, if you were going to have a fire in one vault, this would be the absolute worst one to catch on fire.
Oh, geez. So, but also inside that vault was artwork. I heard you mention that some of the original Y&T cover art was also destroyed.
Yes, that's what we found out as well. Yes.
So throughout the Y&T years on A&M, you'd record an album, the 2-inch tapes and the master tapes. Would you just say, once you guys walked out of the studio, those went back to the company, which at that point was A&M, and then they
Correct.
Just had a system of filing 2 inches here, master tapes over here. And,
exactly.
And you guys really didn't bother with that unless, you know, a decade later you wanted to do a remix, right?
Right. And the basics of record companies back then, even still to today, depending on who you are, but in 99% of the circumstances, the record company keeps the masters. When you are done in the studio, you're not taking those suckers home. You know, they won't let you.
Right.
That's their thing.
That's the money right there.
That's it right there. And they want it forever. I mean, that's the entire thing is that they don't want to give that up. Now, just through, you know, as an aside, I was watching somebody's YouTube channel that was talking about the fire, and he was ranting on about it. And then he mentioned something about something that Jill had found out just recently, but I forgot about, which was that after 35 years have gone by, an artist has the rights to get their copyright back. So not your master tapes, but your copyright. And that's very important for an artist because that means that every time that something's played digitally, streamed, whatever, anybody buys something, that you're no longer sharing it with your record company, you get 100% of that. And so we're trying now to get our copyrights back for Black Tiger, Mean Streak, and Rock We Trust, because 35 years have gone by. And these lawyers that are doing this said they passed a law about this. When they passed the law that said that these artists can get their copyrights back 35 years later, Universal said, we're denying that. We're not going to accept that. So now there's this huge lawsuit that's being filed on behalf of numerous artists. And so that's just, you know, it's never ending.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, we had Phil Lewis of LA Guns on the show, and he was talking about the band is really, they got pretty much a stopwatch for when 30 years rolls up, when they get rights to one album, when they get the rights to the next one. I think they just got the rights for the first debut LA Guns album, and they were able to start distributing it. Now they're waiting for Cocked and Loaded.
That's good. Yeah, because this is Universal and Sony, according to what we understand from the lawyers, that mm-hmm. both of those people are rejecting the termination agreements. So, so there's this big lawsuit, you know, class action lawsuit of numerous artists that said it's probably going to take another 2 years before they can do this. I mean, before they actually get a verdict on it. And they should win because it's the law. You know, they're just plain outright thumbing their nose at everybody and going, no, we don't want to let you have this.
Lawyers and politicians, Dave. Jeez.
Yeah, I know, man.
Now, in terms of the records, okay, so the records from 1981, 1982, that were pressed from the master tapes of like the likes of Earthshaker, Mean Streak, and all that. In absence of those masters now, those records that were pressed back in the day really seem to be the closest vinyl version to the original mixes as we'll ever get from this point forward. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely correct.
Okay. Yeah. But you do, however, have safety copies. It sounds like there's these U-Matics, PCM 1610, 1630s. What are those about? Like,
Well, I've seen them before, and they're sort of cartridges. It's almost like a giant 8-track.
Yeah.
They're people made that for, know what those are.
Yeah, they were made for video. It's kind of a late 80s format, but yeah. Okay, yeah. So the record company would spin duplicates or safety copies onto U-Matics?
Yeah, it's like they gave it to their – probably they gave it to their vault and said, here's your project. Every time you get a master, you know, half inch or quarter inch, you got to make a safety copy or something like that. And I think they also made safety copies on quarter inch analog as well, which of course is – you know, analog to analog copies are not the greatest. I mean, they say even digital to digital is always perfect, but I'll tell you that isn't always true either. So it depends on how you do it, you know.
Right.
But,
and I'd imagine they probably had an intern doing that kind of work as well. So maybe.
Oh, I would. Yeah, I would think so. That would be okay, kid. You know, so here's your job: sweep the floors and make some backups.
All right, kid. Your job here is to make me coffee, clean the toilets, and to manage the Peter Gabriel catalog. Absolutely. So perhaps not the greatest ears that are monitoring this transfer anyway. What would they do with the safety copies? Any idea?
Well, I really not sure. I suppose that if they're going to send something out to somebody that wants to reissue something, I don't know, maybe they'll have to take, you know, issue as to, well, we're not going to send these original masters out to those guys in bum screw somewhere, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, just, you know, Joe Blow that wants to relicense this for, you know, well, let's just give them the U-Matic, you know, because if we lose that, that's all right, we still have the original, or who knows. I mean, this is just me making a possibility of what they do with that. I don't know, actually.
And from what I understand from Universal, they have this what's called Project Phoenix, which is a horrible name. Anyway, it's their recovery effort. They're doing a global search for replacement copies or duplicates of what was destroyed. So any idea? Are you guys getting updates in terms of what they're finding?
Well, the engineer, or I should say the vault manager, that was really a nice guy. He, you know, it's not his fault. And he's probably scrambling like crazy the last month because of all of this. Everybody's asking him, where's this? Where's that? What's lost? What's not? And well, he had told us that there is a few half inch tapes that he found from a couple of those records, but they're marked really weird and he's not sure what they are. And he was going to, you know, look into it and get back to us. Well, that was 2 weeks ago. And we haven't heard another thing back from him. So I don't have a lot of, you know, faith in anything that those things are good or, you know, positive outcomes, but you never know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like that guy's probably one of the most overworked guys in Southern California right now. Yeah. Is Universal, are they being cooperative with you?
In as much as what?
Well, I mean, are they being responsive? Do you feel like, I know they weren't honest initially, but do you think that they're really trying to make things right as best they can?
Well, I guess it depends on who you're talking with. Like when I was telling you, when Jill was getting the rights to, and well, not rights, but the clearances to release these, you know, have these particular songs in the documentary. Of course, you know, they want money for it, and it's a lot of money, and it's outrageous, actually, next to the budget that we had for the documentary, sure, just how much they want. But you know, right away when Jill was negotiating with them, and I said, well, you know, you guys lost the masters to most of these tracks that we're talking about, so maybe you should give us a discount. And then the girl goes, no, we didn't. No, we still have them. And then we found out, no, that's not true. She was totally wrong. So, you know, but no, I mean, you know, the person in the vault has been very forthcoming, and he seems like he's really trying to do the best for everybody that's concerned, given, you know, the terrible job that he has. The rest of the people in Universal, who knows? I don't know. I can't really speak for that.
Now, between 2008, when the fire actually happened, and 2019, when people found out about the fire, were there any requests that you guys made to get a master tape that never came through? Did you experience any runaround during that time period at all?
Not really, because we haven't done any remasters since then to speak of. So yeah, no, it's never been an issue. We never thought twice about it. And there's another article that came out. I don't remember what it was. It might have been the New York Times or something. They did an interview with the vault manager, and he talked about how he's had to live with this for, you know, over a decade, and how much it had really destroyed him personally, because he knew that nobody was talking about it and he couldn't talk about it. And he knew the scope of just all of these amazing classic records that had been destroyed and nobody knew yet, you know? And so he was kind of just living this terrible existence, and, you know, it wasn't his fault. They told him, hey, you ain't saying nothing.
In fact, lie. In fact, yeah. Tell people. Okay.
Well, maybe it's not so much lie, but make a different story out of it. Oh, those were some, I don't know. We'll see.
I think we sent them to Czechoslovakia. Hang on.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you deal emotionally with it? When you found out about this fire, did you know right away? Was there a period of doubt and question? Did you know that you would have been impacted by that?
Well, when I started seeing the likes of all of the masters, the original masters being destroyed, I thought, well, this very well could be the vault where they keep everybody's original masters. And it's a simple thing like that. Okay, original master done, that goes always to this vault. You know, 2-inch goes to this one, so on and so. Oh, we're running out of room in that one. Well, we'll put it to another one. So you always have that possibility that maybe they were running out of room in that vault that got destroyed, and maybe they put some of the original masters in a different one. I was unsure until a separate New York Times article came out 2 weeks after the first, you know, sort of everybody finding out about it. And then they said, here's everybody that lost everything. And I looked down the list, and there we are. So then we went through the hassle of asking the vault manager to find out what's going on and what we have. They're not going to let but nobody at Universal still to this day contacted any artist to tell them. according to what we understand. The artists, it's all up to them if they want to find out what could be missing in their catalog.
So you had to find out by reading a newspaper article and just scanning Absolutely. Down, going all the way down to the Y's and, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh,
that
man.
Was it.
Oh, okay.
You know, this is a music business in general.
Yeah, you know, you're taking a lot better than I would, Dave. I mean, you know, and emotionally, you have to deal with the loss of the tapes. I mean, you're the last remaining original member of Y&T,
right.
And now the tapes, also arguably members of the band, are gone. So was it? I'm assuming it was a tough few weeks for you, at least, yeah?
It was. And I got a call from our original drummer, Leonard Hayes' wife, and she called 3 weeks after this, all of this stuff had gone down, and said, I just heard that, you know, and I'm like, yep, that's exactly what happened. And so it's just interesting that still to this day, there's a whole lot of people that don't know about this. Because it was big news for us, and it was big news for a lot of people that were paying attention. But, you know, there's a whole lot of people that are watching other things in the news, and they're not concerned about, you know, some other story about some fire somewhere. What's that? Who cares? You know, so it's definitely a strange feeling, as you said, to be the only surviving member of the original band, and at the same time going through this myself. You know, basically solely myself, there's nobody else in the original guys to talk to and go, man, this sucks. You know, or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not that it's going to make any difference, but you can have a person that was there with you to go through it. Now we do have my ex-manager, Scott Bure. He was there when we were doing this. So I've never talked to him about it yet, but he's a very busy guy. He's almost always on the road with Steve Miller right now. So,
and you know, in terms of next steps, are you considering your options? I know that there's a big lawsuit that was filed from the likes of Hole and Soundgarden against Universal about this. Is that even in the wheelhouse?
Well, the lawyer that is dealing with us getting our rights back, or I should say our copyrights back from Universal, he said that something akin to that we might be automatically in that judgment because we're one of the people that lost their masters. We don't actually have to attach our name to it per se, but if there isn't an actual judgment on it, that we would be in there with the rest of them,
yeah.
As will and anyone else that lost their masters.
Yeah, what do they call them? The group judgment or something like that.
I
was involved in one of those. I think with an original Apple iPod, and I got a check for about $12 in the mail at one point. So.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I just did the same thing about this security breach, with this company,
Equifax.
And they said, well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, you might get $12 back, but you have to go through about an hour of paperwork to fill it out. And I'm like, never mind.
Yeah, that's the last company I want to give more paperwork to.
Exactly.
All right. So, Dave, thanks for sharing this. You know, I know it must be very, very, very tough for you. And you know, thank God at least there are a few backups that survive. And hopefully this Project Phoenix, this recovery effort, at least unearths some stuff that will happily surprise you and the Y&T fans.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening now. Now, since we last spoke, there's been a record released, Y&T Classic Volume LP, Volume 1, available at yntrocks.com. Tell us about the creation of this. Is the first Y&T vinyl record in 20 years, was it?
Oh, yeah, easily. More than 20 years. Let's see, the last vinyl that was put out was maybe 1990.
So that was
29 years? I guess so. What happened was that our bass player, Aaron, mm-hmm. he had been talking to us about doing an acoustic record. And we talked about it before Aaron was ever in the band. And I remember us sort of going, never mind.
Yeah.
And then Aaron, you know, because Aaron plays in an acoustic band himself when he's not working in Y&T, it's just his own band that he does, you know, gigs on the side.
Yeah. The Vagabond Brothers, I think, yeah?
The Vagabond Brothers, that's right. He had just been saying, you know, we really should do this, man. I'm telling you, that people love hearing these songs, these classic songs acoustically, because it puts a different spin on it, and they can really understand the vocals and the vibe to it, you know, when done in a simplified manner. So I say, okay, let's give it a shot. And we just had some fun with it. I mean, we talked about the fact of doing some different tracks that you wouldn't expect we would want to pick as tracks to do acoustically, such as Barroom Boogie and Black Tiger and things like that. You know, you would think, okay, well, the Slam Dunk, okay, definitely Rescue Me or I Believe in You or something like that, you know, ballads. But you know, nobody's going to figure that we're going to do an acoustic version of Black Tiger. Well, it turns out that was actually really cool. So that's what we would do, is we'd just get into the rehearsal studio and just sit there with three acoustics and the drums, and just start messing around with it and see if we come up with something different and unique, or just literally playing it down like the record, only acoustically, if that's still working or what. And we came up with some really cool stuff, the different bass line for Black Tiger, a different kind of vibe for Barroom Boogie. Yeah, there's a lot of good, interesting things that came out of it. And now we've played, I think, something like five official shows as acoustic Y&T, and they've always been along with a Menichetti Wine release. We've only kind of done it that way because we didn't want to fragment the band's performances as actual Y&T performances. We wanted to keep that always as the electric live thing. And whenever we do an acoustic performance, it's going to be along with a wine tasting or a wine release or something like that. So it's got its own sort of unique place to do that. Yeah.
So I see it's Acoustic Classics Volume 1. Does that mean we can expect a Volume 2 in the near future?
I guess that's why we put Volume 1 on it. That's the only thing I could think of. No, I know. We did. We talked about it. And they said, come on, let's just play Volume 1 because this was so much fun and we can whip these out really quickly and have a lot of fun with it. Let's, you know, we do another one real soon. So, you know, that was the idea.
Yeah.
And we haven't done anything yet. But yeah, I mean, it was fairly quick. I mean, when we got into the rehearsal studio, it took us like 2 days to come up with the songs that we thought were going to be really cool and something different that will put a spin to it. And within, you know, maybe 2 weeks, I guess, we are in the studio, did the recording for it and done. So, yeah, I mean, that's not anywhere near the same when we're doing an actual brand new record electrically. That takes months. I mean, it just does, because you have to figure in the time for writing in that, you know, rather than with these acoustic records, they're the songs that are already written. So it's very simple to change them up or do some different things with them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the limitation of the instruments as well. You don't have to, you know, spend 2 days just getting the snare drum right or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we did use real drums on this, so there was some getting the snare drum right, but not to the craziness factor of doing a real, you know, brand new record with everything in the mix. This is just much more of a simplified drum setup and just three acoustic instruments. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I hope Volume 2 and possibly Volume 3 is not too far in the future here, Dave. I'll put some links up at thevinylguide.com on this episode page where people can order a copy of Y&T Acoustic Classics Volume 1, the EP on vinyl. I think it's $25 or $30 if you want an autographed copy.
Correct.
Also, make sure you check out Menichetti Wines. Dave is a what do they call him? The winemaker? What's the official term?
A vintner.
Excellent.
Yeah, we are an actual winery, so that's what it's all about. We're involved in the whole process from which grapes are being picked. We don't pick them ourselves, but yes, and all the way down to, you know.
All four of you guys aren't in the fields. Aaron's not filling up his cowboy hat full of grapes. No, it's.
You know, the guys might actually enjoy that. You know, the other guys in the band, they don't have anything to do with this. They're, you know, they enjoy drinking it, but other than that, this is not something they're involved in, and it's just as well.
Yeah. Dave, again, thanks for coming on the show. And again, I want to encourage folks to go to yntrocks.com. There you can see the tour dates. Dave and the boys going all around the world. I think they're hitting Santa Cruz later this month and then over to Europe for a while. And then I think there's a whole slate of U.S. shows coming up soon and hopefully beyond. Hopefully one day you'll get to Australia as well, Dave.
Yeah, I think Jill was talking to you earlier, and we were trying. We were trying to make it happen next year, but you know, we'll see what happens. We'll get there eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. Dave, last time you were on the show, we were talking about this Y&T documentary. I've been seeing the teasers for it for going on a couple of years now. When are we finally going to get to see this Y&T documentary?
The documentary is actually coming out this year, and we're just finalizing everything right now as far as what I was talking to you about, getting the clearances for all of the songs on it. It's done. I mean, it's sitting there. It's getting ready. It's ready to be, you know, sorted out and out to the public, but it's going to take a couple of months because the clearances is really the thing that's holding us back at this point. You know, it's finding the people that actually have the clearances to talk to and then waiting for them to get back to us. And of course, then negotiating a reasonable deal so that we don't spend so much money on the documentary that it's ridiculous. But so that's the only thing that's holding it up at this point. But it is officially finished per se. So it let's just put it this way. I don't know when it's coming out, but because this 2-month tour is right in the middle of the whole thing, we'll be in Europe from the middle of September through the middle of November. I would imagine that we'll probably release it when we get home from that. It'll probably, you know, sometime around the end of November.
It'll be a stocking stuffer then, I think is what
you're saying. Indeed, yeah. As it turns out, yeah.
So let me ask you this, because it sounds very very odd to be spending so much time and money licensing your own work for your own project. Do you find that strange?
Yes, I do. I mean, I understand business, and I understand it. So I take it to a certain point, and from just a practical standpoint, it sounds crazy. You know, I mean, even one of the little clips is something that was played on MTV as a little teaser for one of their shows or a show that we were playing, and they wanted us to do it. But now they want us to pay them to play it back. And it's just crazy, man. I mean, some of it makes literally no sense. But from a financial standpoint, I understand where they're coming from, I guess. You know, it's kind of like if a fan takes a picture of you at your show and puts it online. And then you go, hey, man, I really like that shot. If you use it, you get in trouble sometimes, you know, even though it's a picture of you taken by a fan that is not, you didn't hire to do it. You know, it's just, you know, there's some crazy stuff in there, you know, but that's what happens in the entertainment industry.
You're a patient man, Dave. I'm listening to this and you're navigating these waves expertly. I'm just shaking my head at the craziness of it all.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a lot of the stuff that most people don't want to know about and or don't hear about. And, you know, I've been watching these things on YouTube and different guys that have channels that are mainly specifically about rock music. And some of them are like, how to make money in the rock business, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, I got to see this.
First off, buy a gun.
You know, and some of the stuff is like, you know, really outdated information. And I'm thinking, no, it doesn't happen like that anymore. Yeah. Or it never happened like that. You know, no, you can't make money doing that. Well, you could try, but so I've been battered over the head with the business side of things for many, many decades. So I guess that's why I'm taking it in stride a little bit more than I probably you would expect me to.
Yeah. Well, Dave, I'm going to let you go. I know you got something else coming up in about 10 minutes. Give you a bit of a break before that. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks.
I'll talk soon, man.
Appreciate it.
Later. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Thanks again to Dave Menichetti and, of course, his lovely wife, Jill, for enabling this conversation to happen today. Again, I want to direct people over to yntrocks.com. There you can get all the tour dates. You could order the Acoustic Classics Volume 1 record. You can keep your eye out for the documentary, which it sounds like it's coming shortly. You could also follow them at facebook.com/yntrocks. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Hey, if you like this episode, feel free to become a patron of the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. A couple of bucks a month throwing your buddy Nate's way would really make a huge difference. You can do that over at patreon.com/vinylguide. And of course, get exclusive content up there. There's a lot of stuff up there that I don't share elsewhere, including pictures, secret episodes, and a whole lot more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.